You're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Wes Matlock, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks. She had a pet snake. She bought a red guitar.
This episode is brought to you by our patron, Kathy Ferguson, professor of political theory in Star Trek.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Mythgreens Podcast. I'm Oren. With me today is...
Wes.
And joining us for a third time, it is Reese.
Hello. Hopefully you're not sick of me yet.
No, stay.
In fact, I think, if anything, your appearance has gotten better and better as we go on, which is why I brought you back to talk about stories that get better later.
Is this the story of Reese? Okay.
Yes, absolutely. Reese's appearance.
Don't read the first two books of Reese. They're awful. It's a slog. All the character growth happens like four in.
So for the record, most of the time, when somebody tells me that something gets better later, I have found it to not be true.
Mm-hmm.
Usually when something is bad at the beginning, it's just gonna stay bad.
Yeah,
but there are some exceptions. There are exceptions to that rule, and I would like to talk about them.
I would like to quickly follow that up and just say, I think I mentioned this when we did Long Series, that podcast, but I personally have a first story in a series only policy. It's rare that I read past the first book in a series, unless I just like get bored or like decide to get into it. And the reason why, I remember hearing this, this was back when I was like 16 and I got Dune, the first book, and one of my dad's friends said, "Hey, that book is great. Only read that one. Don't read the rest." And I was like, okay. And so I read that book and had a really great time. And then I went on and read other stuff. And so like, that's the first, I mean, that's the thing is like the first book for me in a series is like the litmus test. And it's like, if I like it, great. I enjoyed that book. I will go read something else. If I don't like it, great. I'm done with it. And I'll go read something else. So that's, I'm just laying out there. So I'm very excited to hear about some things that get better like later on.
Well, yeah, most of the ones on my list are actually TV shows, interestingly enough. There's not as many books. But I think the one that people are probably most familiar with is Star Trek The Next Generation.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause that first season it's really bad. Its tone is all over the place. It's like trying to do like more like cerebral, like intellectual stories, but it has like more 1960s camp than a lot of original series episodes.
Do you think that was just like, you know, they pitched the idea and didn't really quite know what they were getting into? Like, is it just about like finding itself later on or what?
I wasn't there when this was all happening, but yeah.
What?
But like, according to some of the people who were, one of them is this guy named David Gerald, who wrote the episode Trouble with Tribbles.
Mm-hmm.
And is a very prolific writer. He was invited to be one of the returning original series writers to be on The Next Generation, and according to him, the first season, like behind the camera, was just a wreck. Like, nobody knew what was going on. It was like Roddenberry was like completely word of God. Like everything Roddenberry said went. Nobody questioned anything.
Oof.
But also Roddenberry was in failing health, and you know hadn't made a show for 20 years, but had been going around talking himself up for all that time, and had kind of started buying his own hype, right?
Oof. Hachi machi.
Yeah. So like, it's that's kind of a recipe for disaster, And then, like, you know, combine that with your normal, like, start of show problems where you're like, you know, you haven't quite figured out what the sets are going to look like yet. And, like, some of the casting decisions are still in question. You know, so that's just a recipe for failure.
Yeah.
And, like, it's notable that in the third season, like, Michael Piller is brought in to sort of revitalize the show and take it in a completely different direction. And he does at that point. Like, he, you know, he eases up on some of the, like, on the idea of Wesley Crusher as the ship's savior. Like, that was a big decision that he made.
Yeah.
Was to do less of that. And just, like, you know, kind of for like made the look a little bit like updated the look of the show to make it look like less like something from the 60s. The uniform change was a really big deal because like the original uniforms with that like that weird looking spandex that gave the actors back problems. And so they changed that and it both looked better and gave the actors fewer back problems. Nice. So just like a general improvement all around, you know. If you watch the first season of The Next Generation, it's like, I would not fault you for never wanting to watch another episode. but, like, at the same time, The Next Generation did eventually become one of the best TV series ever made. So, like, you know, you can turn that around, but, like, it's hard. It requires, like, you to be willing to actually make changes to the show. It helps to bring in new people. And that's what happens with The Next Generation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there definitely needs to be that willingness to sit and look critically at what's been done and what the plan is and really bring in that outside perspective to fully grasp at what is wrong and what is right and take whatever you can that is salvageable and bring it forward, but also bring in all of the other views you're getting. Also just editing, like,
yeah.
edit like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Another show that had a similar, like this one was much faster and, this is a sort of a different scenario. Have either of you guys seen The Librarians?
No.
I have seen one episode and that was very not funny. It was very, very funny. Not intentionally, but it was.
Okay. So The Librarians, I've seen the first season. And The Librarians is a TV show spinoff of a series of direct-to-TV movies that were called The Librarian, singular. And they were basically a Doctor Who ripoff. Like, I don't know which episode you saw, Reese, but the librarian is this guy that could not be more like an off-brand doctor if he's trying, right? He's like, you know, he comes into a room and starts giving a doctor speech is the first time we see him.
Oh, dear.
Where he's like, oh, this is a very fascinating ancient tomb with counterclockwise mobiles. And it's like, oh, God, it's the doctor. What is he doing here? And even, like, the way that he acts is very, like, in like the way that he moves, he flails a lot. It feels very much like the Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And even the music feels very Doctor Who-ish. And in so that was those movies, and from what I understand they were pretty bad, but they decided to make a TV spinoff, and they either because they couldn't afford the actor or because he was, you know, engaged doing other things, the original librarian isn't a main character. So instead, the premise is that they bring in, like, a group of five new librarians to kind of take over for him. And he's in the first two episodes, and the first two episodes are really bad. Because he's there, and he just, like, completely steals the show and is super annoying and, like, just is really overpowered. But then after he leaves, suddenly the other five characters have stuff to do, and they, like, each have an interesting personality. And it's not, like, it's still kind of campy,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, it's never going to be super serious, but it's... it's at least, like, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. It isn't, like, just watching a super overpowered doctor ripoff run around. and so that was, like, I was really surprised at how much better it got after he left.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, it was just like that. And that was clearly, like, that wasn't a case of, like, them, you know, making a decision to change things. It was just that they could only have him for two episodes. And it was, like, once they were no longer allowed to just... have their entire episode rest on one guy, they were like, I guess we actually have to give our other characters things to do. And then they did.
amazing how that will help things.
Yeah, very, very, very nice. Do either of you have one you want to add?
Well, the one that I've been actually recommending to a lot of friends recently, well, I say recently, probably for the past year since I got into it, was mm-hmm. the balance arc of the Adventure Zone, which, if you don't know what it is, it's a Dungeons & Dragons podcast done by the McElroy brothers and mm-hmm. their father, Clint. And the first arc is, or first arc, the first chapter, let's call it, which is yeah. Here There Be Gerblins, is a little bit clumsy, the pacing isn't super great, and everyone's still very much getting their feet wet. And I've told multiple people now, you can skip it if you really want, because they really get their footing in the like second chapter, which is Murder on the Rockport Limited, and and really establish their characters in a lot better better ways. But the reasoning behind that kind of very clumsy start is because they thought it was going to be a one-shot. They thought it was going to be a one-time thing that they would do because Justin was busy with the birth of his new daughter at the time. And so it was just kind of, they clearly didn't really have a good idea of where they were going or what they were doing. And from that, they actually brought this really beautiful, intricate story that lasted, what was it? That's right. It was 69 episodes over several years.
Wait, aren't they still making it?
They are. They're making a new arc now. So basically what they're doing is they're taking turns GMing and playing with different systems. So right now, I think what just ended was the one that Clint, their dad, ran. And it mm-hmm. followed the brothers around as superheroes, basically people who are chosen for a program and imbued with superpowers. And they had to go find someone who had previously been imbued with the powers, but less successfully. So that is that new arc, but definitely with the first, the balance arc, it started out real rough. Like, it's still listenable, but it was rough.
Well, and that makes perfect sense, because, I mean, they were, like, literally learning how to do a, you know, an RPG podcast, right?
Yeah, and learning how to play an RPG for literally all of them. Like, I think the one who had the most experience was Travis, because he had played one one-shot.
Wow.
Yeah.
And, like, don't they, maybe this is just for specific circumstances, but my understanding was that they're pretty responsive to feedback from their audience, right?
Oh, goodness, yes. Yes, they are. That's one of the really cool things is, during one of the early chapters, Pedals to the Metal, there are a lesbian couple, and spoiler, they end up dying, and a bunch of fans were like, "Hey, Griffey, you buried your gays." And he was like, "I did what now?" And he just sort of wasn't really aware of that trope. And later down the line, he listened and he was like, "Okay, I'm going to try and do better about this." And they've done that with several things, including the fact that Justin named his character Taco Taco, spelled T-A-K-K-O-T-A-C-C-O. Just as kind of a joke, and the quest, his character quest was going to be to make the taco. And because it was a one-off and he wasn't really thinking about it, he's like, "I am a white dude playing an elf wizard who's going to invent a thing that is from not a culture I am from and not a culture that this character represents, so I'm going to fix this down the line." And they actually do very well address that.
Cool. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, this is why I don't let anyone with microphones near my games. But I mean, like, that's a, if you know, for a show like that, especially for something that's like, because the McElroy brothers are like very recognizable by their personality, right? Like, when a lot of the times when you're following their stuff, it's because you like them as, like, you know, as media personalities.
Exactly.
It's very important to be responsive, mm-hmm, right? Because, mm-hmm, you know, if they start acting like jerks, that takes away, if, for one thing, it's rude, but it's also just like takes away a lot of what makes their shows work.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, that's, so it's, they both, that's a case of, like, they both learned technically what they were doing and were responsive when their audience, like, asked them to make changes. So, that's really cool. I'm a big fan. On the book side, there, the most, like, striking example that I can ever think of is Discworld.
Yeah, those got better, definitely.
Right. Well, and it's interesting because, so, like, reading The Color of Magic, it's pretty clear to me that that Pratchett didn't really know what he was doing with this.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm,
he has this big world that he's setting, but at the same time, it's like Color of Magic is just leans too heavily on satire. Like, because all the Discworld books have a certain level of satire to them.
Yeah,
they're all, a lot of them are poking fun at various fantasy tropes, but Color of Magic is like all satire. It doesn't have anything else. And so it's just not that interesting. It's like, once you, it's like, it's, oh god, it's kind of funny. He's like made fun of the Chosen One trope, and okay, that's cool. But after that, it's like, all right, now what?
Yeah.
And as the books go on, and even like the first few aren't super great, and Pratchett like both like gets better at Wordcraft for one thing. He like learns Wordcraft. But then he also like, he figures out what he's doing with Discworld, right? Which is making a fantasy setting that has a lighter theme and, like, is, you know, kind of unique and different, but isn't, like, an active parody,
mm-hmm,
which is why the later Discworld books have so much more staying power.
Right.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, in The Color of Magic, it's like, who cares what happens to Ankh-Morpork? It's literally a joke. it's a joke of a city. But then, like, as you get further in, it's like, okay, no, Ankh-Morpork is actually a city. Like, it actually, like, has character, and, like, you start to care about it. And so, like, when it's threatened, it's like, ooh, no, not Ankh-Morpork. I don't want to see that city destroyed, right? So that's just a pretty clear case of the author, like, starting off without like a super clear idea of what's happening, and then like getting more into it. I'm curious, and there's not really a way to test this, but I have my suspicions that like Pratchett, that like, because that like the publishing industry was like less crowded when Pratchett first started, so that may have been how he got his start at all. It's questionable to me whether he would have been published if he'd been writing today. I don't know that for a fact. I just kind of wonder, because his first book is really hard to get into, and that's like something publishers really care about.
Right. Yeah.
It's like accessibility.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about books, and yeah, I'm glad you brought up Pratchett and Discworld, because I was looking through my bookshelves for series that I have and that I have read, and I was trying to find one that, you know, fits the bill. Mm-hmm. And I think we can talk about Harry Potter in a few minutes.
Sure.
But the one that I do have that I think does fall in here is Stephen King's Dark Tower series. You know, there's 7 books, and I think he wrote the first one, The Gunslinger. I think he wrote that in like the early 70s. And the next, like, book 2 showed up like 10 years later, maybe, or something like that. Like, he definitely wrote, I think the last book showed up in the late 20-aughts, maybe. I think I remember that showing up around then. But like, it definitely is like, if somebody said, hey, like, which is, does it get better later? I would say absolutely yes. Like, you kind of, I guess you could just, I mean, I would recommend like reading a summary of like the first book. You don't have to sit through it. It's not that interesting, because what you said with like Discworld is like, he couldn't quite figure out like the grander like universe that he was kind of building. Cause like, if you read Stephen King books, he has his own kind of mythos in a way. And it's not in all of his books, but like, you know, they just remade the It movie. That book is one of the larger looks into his fictional world's mythos. And like, once that book came onto the scene, that's kind of when like the Dark Tower books really started figuring out what they were doing. Like that the gunslinger like is more than just some kind of like knight errant with revolvers. Like he's in this plane that connects to all the worlds of existence, that connects to all the books that like Stephen, like it gets like quite grand. And wow. And the thing is like it really like reaches a great, like book two is pretty good, but it still like feels like it's warm up material because you get three more main characters, and then when their stories get fleshed out in like 3, 4, and 5, it's like, oh, awesome. But then at that point, like I liked 6 and 7, but it kind of just got a little too big for it, right? Like it snowballed and then started breaking apart.
Right.
And I think that with longer series, that can often go. It's like, you know, stories that get better later and then kind of fall, you know, a little bit. But yeah. I definitely like think that if anybody were to just like, you know, go through the first couple books of that, they would be rewarded, definitely. And it's fascinating to read a series that basically also spans almost the entirety of an author's writing career. So that's interesting.
His voice would like change over that time, right? Like that's a,
oh, you know, yeah.
Like he would probably sound different by the end.
Yeah. Right? There's, book 5, I think is called The Wolves of the Kala. And the voice is completely different between books 4 and 5. And, the time between those two is when he got hit by a van and he almost died. Like, oof, right. And like, oof. And that, you know, that surprise, like spoilers, I guess, like that incident, like makes its way into like a later story, I think in book 6. But yeah, like the whole attitude towards the books for the like 5, 6, and 7 changed, and like the tone changed. It's still like the main same essence of things, but the way he started relating it, like, yeah, it took on a whole new interesting aspect, which like was cool, but also like different from what I had grown to like to enjoy and expect from 2, 3, and 4. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now the real question is if there is a king mythos, you know, then when can I get my carry it crossover where Pennywise is like, come to the sewers, children, and Carrie just like explodes.
Oh, yes. That would be awesome.
When can that
be
happen?
So cool.
And yeah. Then you see a car drives into the sewer. Bring Christine in here too.
One thing that I've noticed, especially with TV, a big part of the reason why things get better in later episodes is that very often what will happen is the TV show will start, and whoever's in charge will be like, this TV show has to be like this, no risks. And then later, as the show becomes more viable and like it attracts an audience, they're like, okay, you can try doing some more edgy things now. The Clone Wars animated series is like probably the best example of that I can think of, because its first season is just like what is happening here? it's you know, just it's like it's super just like not good, but it's clearly like, I think like clearly, I feel like the writers of that show were given a mandate that was like, this show has to attract, it has to be like the prequels in tone, right? It has to like try to attract like really young kids. And so it has to be like really silly and over the top and kind of ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And then like, as that goes forward, they were like the show actually had an audience. They were like, okay, this is a story about a war. It's like not really a kid's story,
right?
So it gets more serious, and like the characters start to develop more, and like the clones, like they actually give, like before at the beginning of the show, the clones are just like, you know, it's kind of a joke is that they're all the same.
Mm-hmm.
But then like as the show goes on, the clones, like their difference in personality becomes what makes the show, right?
Yeah.
It's like, you have a bunch of clones who all look the same and have like the same voice actor, so like finding ways to differentiate them becomes really interesting, and like the way that they respond to different problems is my favorite part. Like the Jedi are okay, you know. I don't hate Anakin in the Clone Wars, which is a significant accomplishment. there are later episodes where I don't even hate Jar Jar Binks.
Oh my! Wow.
Weird. But, like, the real meat of the show are the clones, and they're allowed to like take more center stage as the show gets, you know, advances, because like I think the directives relaxed and it was like, okay, it doesn't have to be as much about Jedi and like this weird hut that we introduced in the first season. He can leave now, whatever. And it doesn't have to be as much about like the, you know, Count Dooku and the whatever that droid guy's name was with the whirly arms and the lightsabers. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that guy. Yeah, he had a grievance with something, I think.
Our sweet spindly man.
Yeah, everyone loves the spindly man. The Clone Wars also like explained why he has like lungs, which was always weird to me. But anyway, the Clone Wars is definitely like, I think it's fine for you to skip season one and maybe even two. But like later on, I'd say it is like a legit story. And like if you are into Star Wars and, you know, like 99% of Star Wars fans don't like the prequels, it's like, well, the Clone Wars gives you like a decent idea of how maybe they could have been good. Hmm. You know, maybe.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So I will talk about the second one first, but I first got to mention that Avatar Last Airbender.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing, and then it's amazing, and then it's amazing. And that
just goes,
that is the truth.
Yeah.
But I would say Korra falls into this category. I like the first few episodes of season one, and then I was just like, oh man, they're missing so many things that made like Airbender great. Mm-hmm. But then I felt like it came back, like, you know, the final season of Korra. Mm-hmm. I was like, yes, like this is what we like in this like show, in this world. Like, you guys have any thoughts on that? Or
Reese, why don't you go first?
Oh, well, I guess, when they pulled back and stopped focusing too heavily on the triangle, I think it improved by leaps and bounds, and they really did start bringing in more of what made Airbender so successful and honestly something that's worth rewatching every year. Completely
agree.
And I think it may have been, again, what we were talking about earlier, where it's like, yeah, we have to establish this and go within these set lines and bring these certain things that this writer or showrunner definitely wants, and from there we can expand and do better. And that may have also been, I wasn't super keyed into it when it was first coming out, but that may have partially been influenced by fan reaction, if I'm remembering correctly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I don't think Mako was a particularly popular character.
Nope.
Right? And so I think they realized that the love triangle with Mako, Korra, and Asami was just not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got Korosami, which is possibly the greatest relationship on TV. but, you know, so I feel like what happened with early Korra is a combination of bad executive decisions, but also bad storytelling decisions. Because, like, my understanding is that behind the scenes, they never knew if they were going to get another season.
Right, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I heard that too.
Okay, so they were like, we don't know if there's going to be a season two. So, and we have fewer episodes in season one, because each Last Airbender series or season was like 20 episodes,
mm-hmm.
whereas the Korra seasons are 12 episodes. So we have fewer episodes, and we don't know if there's going to be another season, so we have to be, we can't like, you know, we can't leave things open at the end of the season. We have to wrap them all up. And so that's why at the end of season one, you have the Deus Ex Avatar state that fixes all of the bending that people lost, yeah, right?
Right.
But within that, there are still some kind of baffling choices that they made, like introducing General Iroh, who is like Mako again some more, right? It's just like another young firebender who is like notable because he sounds kind of like Zuko. And it's like, why is this guy here? What is happening? And like, you know, they have like the pro bending story.
Yeah.
And it's like, what is that? what does the pro-bending story accomplish? We don't have time for this. So, like, you know, season one is just a case of, like, we too much story crammed into too few episodes. And then season two is even worse. Yeah. And they waste, like, an entire episode of season two on Korra having amnesia.
Yep. Yeah.
And it's like, what was up with that? Mm-hmm. And then, but then, like, season four, the reason season four works, I think, is because they actually laid the groundwork for it in season three. And I don't know if that's because someone finally told them that they were getting a fourth season, or if they were just like, to hell with it. We're laying groundwork and, you know, whatever. If they don't give us another season, who cares? I don't know which that was, but, you know, they also got rid of things that weren't working. They cut a bunch of extraneous characters. So I wouldn't be surprised if they brought in someone from outside. Like, I don't think this person is credited anywhere, but I wouldn't be surprised if they brought in an outside consultant who, like, told them what was wrong with their show.
Yeah.
Because in my experience, it's very rare for a storyteller to just spontaneously look at their story and know what's wrong with it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that for a fact. That's just my suspicion based on my experience as an editor. All right, well, thank you very much for joining us again, Reese, because we are out of time.
Thank you, Reese.
Thanks for having me again.
Of course, it was excellent. And thank you for bringing up the McElroy brothers. Their podcast is like a form of storytelling I would not have considered. So those of you at home, if anything we said piqued your interest, you can email us at podcast@mythkoreans.com. Otherwise, we will talk to you next week.
If you enjoyed this podcast and want to slip us some gold-pressed latinum, head over to patreon.com/mythcreants. We appreciate it. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. He was bigger than a whale, and his breath was terrible. He scared the princess when he came around. Tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean.
This has been the Mythgreant Podcast, opening closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Colton.